types of sannyasis. So four types of sannyasis are described, and the ultimate one is called the Paramahansa. And so the four types are gradually more and more renounced. We have the first two are more or less dependent on society, and they get donations to live from other people, the grihasthas. The Pararajika, he just wanders around the world, so he's more detached. And then ultimately the Paramahamsa, he is the most exalted of all. He's completely detached from everything, and he doesn't even follow rules and regulations at that point. So the previous verses were talking about this. He says, then that person may give up even his designations, such as the cloth and the danda and the water pot, etc., which makes sannyas as part of the ashram. And he just wanders around completely undistinguishable from everybody else because you can't tell he's a sannyasi or whatever. So that is considered the highest position in the Varnashram system. As far as Vaishnavas are concerned, we find that there is the rule, of course, that in Kali Yuga you shouldn't take sannyas. That's one rule. And so everyone says, why we have sannyas? Of course, we'll see that sannyas ashram in Madhva Sampradaya and Sri Sampradaya and other Sampradayas as well. Even Shankaracharya has sannyas, etc. So there are exceptions. But in Kali Yuga, it is more difficult to take sannyas, especially if we concentrate on the renunciation aspect. So that is quite prominent in the examples given here. In the next section, it talks about the person who lived like a python. He was so advanced that he was unattached to eating and sleeping and everything. And he would just lie down on the ground, and if people offered food, he would eat it. If nobody offered, he wouldn't take it. He didn't care for public opinion or anything. So, very renounced person. So the emphasis is, we can see externally, on renunciation, so that we can't even tell what he is anymore. And this verse here describes that he doesn't speak, even if he is eloquent. He acts as if he cannot speak at all, like a dumb man. So he may be very knowledgeable, but he doesn't say anything or reveal his knowledge to anyone. So in other words, he hides his identity. So this is quite a typical description of a renounced, ultimately renounced person. And we'll see, for instance, if you go to Kumbh Mela, there are many yogis and people like that. Similar, they sit in caves in the Himalaya and they live very simply, etc. They're not concerned with the material world at all. But, as I said, the Vaishnavas really are not so concerned with that. And in fact, in the Nectar Devotion, Rupa Goswami talks about Vairagya. And he says Vairagya is not a part of bhakti. It's not a cultivation of bhakti like hearing the Lord's pastimes or chanting the Lord's name or worshipping the deity or cooking for the deity. These are parts of bhakti. Renunciation or vairagya is not a part of bhakti as such. And then the reason is given, because it dries up the heart. If we concentrate on renouncing everything, what happens is we lose our attraction for the Lord, and we become more attracted to the impersonal aspect. So renunciation also has this tendency to take you in the direction of formless Brahman and liberation rather than service to the Lord. So, therefore, it's not considered to be an anga of bhakti. On the other hand, we do see that the qualification for bhakti is not to be too attached to material enjoyment. But then the other statement is not to be too detached also. So, in other words, we shouldn't involve ourselves too much in cultivating detachment, like as Rupa Goswami says, but at the same time, we cannot be too attached to the material world. That's our qualification to begin bhakti. So in other words, Krishna and the scriptures are very merciful to us, and they allow us, okay, you don't have to renounce everything to start bhakti. You don't have to be a sannyasi to start bhakti. You can start anywhere. Anybody in the Varnashram system, outside the Varnashram system, can start bhakti. He doesn't have, he could be a grihastha, he could be a sannyasi, he could be a brahmachari, he could be an outcast without any varna or ashram. He could practice bhakti if he has a little detachment, not too much, not too attached to material things, and not too detached also. And that's the qualification for bhakti. We do have to have some sort of detachment. But the reason that we don't cultivate detachment as an anga of bhakti is that detachment arises naturally with the advancement of bhakti. So advancement of bhakti can be measured in terms of attraction to Krishna. If we're more attracted to Krishna, we're more advanced in bhakti. We're less attracted to Krishna, less advanced in bhakti. And the more we're attracted to Krishna, the less we're attracted to material things, the more renounced we are. So instead of cultivating detachment, we cultivate attachment. Attachment to Krishna. So attachment to Krishna leads to disinterest in material acquisition, material affairs, etc. That's the automatic result. Why is that? The answer is because if we actually become more attracted to Krishna, the very definition of that is anya abhilashita shunya. Our attraction for Krishna is combined with complete lack of desire for anything else. Our desire for Krishna means automatically we don't want material things. So we're not becoming attracted to Krishna to get anything material from Him or to get liberation from Him. So we want neither material benefits nor liberation or destruction of our suffering, etc. Our purpose in worshipping Krishna is simply what? Worshipping Krishna to please Krishna. So, automatically by doing that, we become detached from material things. In other words, the more we become attached to pleasing Krishna, then the less attached we are to material things. So the whole progress of bhakti is measured in terms of attachment to the Lord and detachment from everything else. So we have bhajana kriya, anarchana vritti, nishta, ruchi, asakti, bhava, and prema. So in the beginning there is a little attachment to the Lord, and there's great attachment to material things. So it's not very steady as a result. That we call anishita bhakti. So we have shraddha, we practice bhakti, but it is unsteady. Not so much attraction for Krishna, lots of attraction for material things. Therefore, unsteady. So sometimes we can chant, sometimes we cannot chant. We've got to do other things. We've got to engage our mind materially. Sometimes we can hear about Krishna, sometimes we want to hear something else. So that's anishtata, unsteady. The attraction for material things is more. But the process of bhakti is such that by more engagement in the process of bhakti, hearing, chanting, remembering, deity, worship, etc., by doing these processes more and more, the attraction for Krishna increases, and consequently, attraction for Maya decreases. So, when we reach a point where the attraction for Krishna is slightly more than the attraction for material things, we can practice our bhakti steadily. This we call nishtha, steadiness in bhakti. So that is a very good stage to reach, because then we don't have much problem with material distractions. Even if there's there's Kali Yuga and there's many distracting elements all around us, we're not disturbed by that. We continue our devotional service nicely. So that's the stage of nishtha. So if we reach nishtha stage, it's very easy to advance. If we're at anishtha, it's very difficult because we're not steady. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't do. So we reach nishtha, that means attraction for Krishna is a little bit stronger. When it becomes more strong and attraction for Maya is less, and then we have ruchi, it becomes quite evident that we have attraction for Krishna. We have attraction for the processes of bhakti, hearing, chanting, remembering. We like to do them. And we're very attached to them. And we're very attached to Krishna within those processes. It becomes asakti. And then we become so attracted to Krishna, even though we still have a little bit of anartha, Krishna appears. So Krishna is very merciful, and even if we're not completely pure, He will make His appearance directly to the individual. That is called bhava. So we establish a spiritual relationship called bhava with the Supreme Lord at the bhava stage, and the Lord manifests Himself, and we get spiritual eyes to see the Lord at that stage. But still not complete. A little bit of anartha is there. And then final stage, no anartha at all. Only attraction to Krishna. That is prema. So, the concentration is on the activities of bhakti. Not upon trying to get rid of things and renounce things, etc. But the renunciation happens automatically with the more and more attraction to Krishna as we go through these stages. So, without conscious effort, if one reaches bhava or prema, we can say that the material attraction is very little and ultimately nil. This is in contrast to the jnanis and yogis who must consciously practice vairagya as part of their sadhana. That means disengagement of the senses from objects in this material world, so we don't have any enjoyment. And then disengagement of the mind from those objects also, so the mind becomes completely peaceful. So that is a cultivation. In the yoga process we have, what is it, pratyahara and all of this, the dharana and dhyana, withdrawal of our senses from material objects, etc. And in jnana, we have the jnanis are famous for taking sannyas, cultivating detachment, living in a solitary place, mona vrata, stopping speaking, etc. These are all part of jnana process. And meditating, I'm not the body, I'm not the body, I'm not the body, I am the soul, I am the soul, I am the soul. So this is the process of jnana. So jnana and yoga concentrate on the detachment. Material things are bad, material attachment is bad, let's get rid of that material attachment by stopping the senses and stopping the mind and meditating on one point. The process of bhakti is don't stop the mind, don't stop the senses. Engage the senses in Krishna and have the mind and the senses become more attracted to Krishna, more absorbed in Krishna. Automatically, we become, the senses and the mind become detached from material enjoyment. So, the process of bhakti is much easier than the process of jnana and yoga because we don't have to stop the senses and stop the mind, we engage them instead. So, therefore, bhakti is a process which is available for everybody, whereas jnana and yoga are not available for everybody. First, you have to be qualified by sattva-gun. And once you're fixed in sattva-gun, then you can practice. So, a jnani must be a brahman. A brahman has to be in sattva-gun. A brahman's in sattva-gun. And then once he's a brahman in sattva-gun, fixed there, studying the Vedas, then he's qualified to begin the jnana process and study Vedanta Sutra. And withdraw his mind from everything in the material world. So it requires qualification to start the practice of jnana. And the same with yoga. The first two angas of yoga are what? Yama and niyama. Which means you have to have brahmacharya, control your senses, all the preliminaries are there before you can actually get into even asana and pranayama. So all of this requires a very sattvic mentality and disposition before you start. Bhakti doesn't require that. You can start anywhere. Tamogun, Rajogun, Sattvagun. And the remarkable thing is, bhakti actually is beyond the gunas completely. It is nirguna because it's part of Krishna. It is Krishna's Sarup Shakti. And jnana is part of Sattvagun. It arises from Sattvagun. And in order to get liberation, you have to give up the process of jnana, because in liberation there is no sattva-gun. So you give up jnana ultimately. These processes are in the gunas. Bhakti is beyond the gunas. But you can practice bhakti in any of the gunas. Very strange. We should say that you have to be near guna to practice bhakti, because it's beyond the gunas. But no, you can practice in any guna. Whereas jnana and yoga only in sattva gun. And if you're not in sattva gun, what do? You practice karma yoga. If you're in tamagun and rajagun, you practice karma yoga. And then through that practice, tamagun person can gradually get purified and become rajagun gradually. After many births, he comes to sattva gun. Then he can practice jnana. So qualifications are necessary in the gunas for these other processes. But for bhakti, it is nirguna. So in one sense, yes, to practice bhakti properly, you should be nirguna. Beyond the gunas. But at the same time, anybody who's a human being can do bhakti. Very great contradiction. How is it possible? Only a nirguna person should practice bhakti, which is nirguna. But no, person in the lowest tamagun can also practice bhakti. Why? Because the qualification is not according to gunas at all. Qualification is shraddha, faith in the Lord. And faith in the Lord, conviction in the Lord's existence, and a willingness to worship Him does not arise by gunas at all. It arises by mercy of devotees only. And mercy of devotee can be manifest to a person in tamagun, rajagun, or sattvagun. The devotees are very merciful, and they give mercy everywhere. So if one happens to get that shraddha, and one is in tamagun due to bad karmas or whatever, still, he can practice bhakti, which is very special. It's beyond the gunas completely. How can that be, though? It's because of the mercy of Krishna. Krishna doesn't care about your gunas at all, whether you're in sattva-gun or tamagun. What he cares about is you have some favorability towards Krishna, which may arise in any guna. And based on that, you practice the bhakti. But by the practice of bhakti, which is near guna, you go beyond the gunas much quicker than you can go by getting to sattva gun through karma yoga, coming to sattva gun, and then practicing many lifetimes yoga or jnana, and then finally getting moksha, going beyond the gunas. Very slow process, many, many births. Process of bhakti, very quick. Why? Because it is nirguna, but not, it's not impersonal Brahman nirguna. It is nirguna because it is part of Krishna, and Krishna is most merciful. So bhakti is actually the shakti of Krishna, the bhakti shakti of Krishna. And what is it composed of? Hladini and Samvit shakti. Lord's internal energy. That's bhakti. And within that we have mercy. The kripa shakti is within all that. So bhakti is a combination of kripa and hladini, bliss, and samvit, knowledge, shakti of the Lord, internal shaktis of the Lord in the spiritual world. So that bhakti is very, very powerful because it's part of Krishna. And not only is powerful, but it's completely untouched at all stages by anything in the material world. So therefore, a person in tamagun can also practice bhakti, and bhakti remains uncontaminated by the gunas. The Lord is not contaminated. Krishna could kill a demon, he touches a demon, not contaminated at all. Holy name, not contaminated by anything in the material world. Bhakti, not contaminated by anything in the material world. So anybody can contact bhakti, do bhakti, and it remains pure. It remains Vishuddha sattva in all cases. But it's part of the Lord. Not only is it part of the Lord, it is the, we can say, the most attractive part of the Lord. So that the unique quality of bhakti in the nectar devotion in the beginning chapter is described, first chapter is described, unique qualities of bhakti. There's six qualities. Now the sixth quality is the ultimate quality of bhakti. This it makes it different from karma and jnana and yoga. And what is that? Krishna Karshani. Bhakti attracts Krishna. And particularly Prem Bhakti attracts Krishna. It attracts Krishna so much that Krishna serves the devotee, the Prem Bhakta. He becomes a servant of the Prem Bhakta. Krishna becomes a servant of Mother Yasoda and gets tied up by Mother Yasoda. Krishna becomes the charioteer of Arjuna, which is an inferior position even though he's Supreme Lord. So Krishna is so attracted by bhakti, he is controlled by the bhakti and the devotee, particularly in prema. So bhakti is very attractive to Krishna. And it's his most powerful energy. So if a little bit of bhakti appears in a person in the material world, we have Shraddha and we start a little process of bhakti by association with devotees, the Lord is attracted to that. It's a little bit of bhakti. Of course, that person also, he's just beginning bhakti, also has a lot of maya. So a little attraction to Krishna, a little bhakti there in the jiva, but a lot of maya also there, a lot of ignorance. Still, the Lord is attracted to that bhakti. A little bit of bhakti is there. The Lord is attracted to that. So, the Lord personally helps the devotees. He does not help the jnani and the yogi. It's all their endeavor. They have to do their own work. And that's why it's slow process, hard, difficult. As Krishna says in chapter 12 of Bhagavad Gita, Kleshadikara. That process of realizing Brahman is full of difficulties, full of suffering. You really have to put a lot of effort into to try to control the mind and the senses and renounce everything, etc. Krishna helps the devotee. And Krishna promises in chapter 12 of Bhagavad Gita, very quickly, I will deliver you from the ocean of samsara. Destroy all of your karmas. Destroy all the suffering. Destroy your concept of the material body. And take you to the spiritual world. So it's the impersonal endeavor of the Lord involved in the process of bhakti, because bhakti shakti is part of the Lord, and the Lord's controlled by that bhakti. So it is said that as one develops in bhakti, then the Lord appears in the heart, and he destroys all the anarthas and all the karmas, etc. So who was that Lord? It is not Paramatma who's in everybody's heart anyway, and he doesn't do anything. He doesn't destroy all your karmas, because people are still suffering even though Paramatma's there. This is Bhagavan. Krishna's in the heart. He's destroying all your karmas. Even for the sadhaka, the Lord is there. He's doing for the devotees. He's helping the devotees. So the Lord is personally involved in the process of bhakti from the very beginning stages. And therefore, it's a very quick process compared to the other process. It's a much easier process compared to the other process. And susukam kartamavyayam, it is easily performed, very happily performed. Why? Because we don't have to stop the senses and the mind. We can engage them nicely, and we have all sorts of nice objects to engage in. So we can hear the singing of the Lord's name, or the classes about descriptions of Krishna and his pastimes, or we can sing about Krishna, or we can see the beautiful forms of the deity. So plenty of engagement, lots of nice sounds and colors, etc., to stimulate our senses for Krishna. So easy process also. So this is the way in which we end up in this position described here, where the person could ultimately be completely detached from everything material. But the idea is not simply to attain a state like this. That's not the purpose of the devotee. The purpose of the devotee is simply to please Krishna more and more and more. And when he does that to a high degree, then he becomes like this, completely unattached to anything in the material world. So we see the Goswamis in Vrindavan, Rupa and Sanatana and Jiva and others. They were completely detached from everything in the material world, but they were not cultivating detachment at all. They were simply attached to Krishna completely. That's all. And therefore, they were detached from everything in the material world, detached from the material bodies, detached from everything. So it was a natural result of more attachment to Krishna. So in the 11th canto of Bhagavatam, the different types of devotees are described: the Kanishta and the Madhyama and the Uttama. And the Uttama fits this category here because he is completely detached from everything in the material world. He sees everything in Krishna and Krishna in everything. And there's many verses describing this Uttama Bhakta. Of course, in the Nectar Devotion there, and describing Prema Bhakti, Rupa Goswami says, we cannot discuss the Prema Bhakta because he's indescribable. There's no rule. He doesn't follow any rule. You can't say he has to dress like this or he has to conduct himself like that. He's completely beyond all rules and regulations. So that is sort of said here, that one may be a sannyasi, but then he may even give up sannyasa ashram and not dress like a sannyasi, not carry a danda, not act like a sannyasi at all. One doesn't know what he is, as in the case of this python sadhu. He looked like a beggar lying down on the ground in the forest. Nobody knew what he was. So in prema or in uttama bhakta, that's the position. He is so absorbed in the Lord, we cannot predict how he's going to act in relation to the material world. But that's the external appearance. The important part of that uttama bhakta is he is concentrated on the Lord. So therefore, the definition there is he sees a Krishna in everything and everything in Krishna. It's not simply he's detached from everything in the material world. And it's not simply that he's an Atmarama. He's just content to be Atma or part of Brahman, like the impersonalists. No. They're also complete, and they can act like this also, detached. His detachment is because of seeing everything in Krishna and Krishna in everything. Seeing Krishna in everything means that when he looks at anything in the material world, any material element, any material object, he understands that it has a relationship with the Supreme Lord, Krishna, somehow or other. Now, of course, anyway, Paramatma's there for all living entities or whatever, but that's not the vision for a person in prema. He's not concerned with Paramatma even. He's concerned with Bhagavan, Krishna. So somehow he sees everything in the material world related to the pastimes of the Lord, or for the arranged for the pastimes of the Lord. All the material elements, everything in the material world is somehow related to Bhagavan and his pastimes. And therefore he offers respects to everything in the material world as being related to Krishna. Krishna's using this object for his purpose. And he sees the Lord in everything, and he sees everything in the Lord. That means he sees everything is concentrating on the Lord. Everything is absorbed in the Lord. Everybody's a prema bhakta. Even the demons are prema bhaktas. And therefore, he doesn't make a distinction between demon and devotee, as the Madhyamarikari does. The Madhyamarikari thinks, this is a non-devotee. We should not preach to them. We should not associate with them. They're asasanga. We will preach to the devotees. Prema bhakta, everybody's a devotee. We don't preach to anybody because they're all prema bhaktas already. That's his vision. Everybody is a devotee of the Lord, the prema bhakta, even the asura. How can the asura be a prema bhakta? So that's explained by Jiva Goswami. He says in one place that one way of looking at it is that ultimately Krishna is within that person, and he's the punisher of that person. So he is giving his mercy to that person by punishing him, punishing the demon. And the other way of looking at it is that somehow or other they're acting for the Supreme Lord, in spite of the fact that they're demons or whatever. So, in any case, that Uttamadhikari sees everything in relation to the Supreme Lord. And the example is given of the people of Vrindavan, like the gopis, when they see the trees. They see the trees as devotees of the Lord, and the trees are serving the Lord, and the trees are bowing down and offering their flowers and fruits to the Lord, and they're going into ecstasy, and they're shedding tears of ecstasy in terms of the sap flowing from the trunks of the trees. And they're like hair standing on end. The leaves are bustling around like this. So that's how they see all the living entities somehow serving the Lord. So in other words, every living entity is in prema for the Lord. That's how they, that's the prema bhakta, how they see everything. And consequently, they don't relate to the material world as other people do. We relate to the material world in terms of this is good or this is bad. This is nice for me, that is bad for me. I like this, I don't like this. Or as a devotee, this is favorable for devotional service, this is unfavorable for devotional service. But for the Prem Bhakti, everything is in Prema. Everything is part of the Supreme Lord. Everything is serving the Lord in Prema. And they are always in ecstasy. So that is a very exalted state. Consequently, they have no interest in the material body or in society or anything else. And they may act exactly as is stated here. They act like a person who's dumb. They don't speak. They don't display that they are a knowledgeable person at all, an educated person or whatever. They don't display any signs of being intelligent or whatever, or being eloquent at all. They're not interested in material world and making it a slave for the material world. Only interest is pleasing the Supreme Lord, relating everything else to the Supreme Lord. So that's the position of this ultimate devotee. So that's a very elevated position to reach. And in the beginning of devotional service, we cannot imitate such a stage. We have to advance gradually. And if one reaches bhava and prema, then automatically this arises. So the idea is not that we're trying to cultivate detachment. We're only trying to cultivate attachment to Krishna. So our immediate aim is to develop more and more attachment, and at least we come to nishtha stage, where we can steadily practice, and there we can advance to higher stages. So that's the endeavor of the devotee. And in doing so, he will automatically develop a detachment from all these material things. So this is how the devotee can manage himself in this material world. So Kali Yuga is a very disturbing place. More disturbing externally for people. Things to stimulate the senses to develop material attraction, etc. Very, very difficult. Still, the process of bhakti operates even in this situation. And the main process it operates is Nam Sankirtan. This is the Yuga Dharma. And this is the great blessing of Kali Yuga. Everything else is bad in Kali Yuga. Everything is full of ignorance and distraction. But bhakti is there. And bhakti in the form of chanting the holy name of the Lord is there to counteract this completely. How is it possible, we say? It's the power of the name and the power of bhakti. So the power of the name is such that even accidental chanting can destroy 100% of your karmas instantaneously. How is it possible? All your anarchists suddenly disappear. Happens. So Ajamil had all of his karmas destroyed by saying, I name my son Narayana. And when he said the name Narayana, all of his karmas disappeared. That's the power of chanting the holy name, even accidentally, what to speak of chanting it with devotion. So the process of chanting is very powerful. Among all the process of bhakti itself is powerful because it's not different from the Lord, but holy name is particularly useful because very simple. It's the name of the Lord, that's all it is. And we can utilize it anywhere, anytime, any place, whatever. And it has great, great power because it's non-different from Krishna himself. So it can destroy all the karmas, destroy all the obstacles to that. And that's the negative aspect. The other positive aspect is give us more and more attachment to Krishna. So, that is the process that we follow. We're not trying to imitate these elevated souls. Rather, we adhere to the process of bhakti, then naturally, 100% attachment to the Lord will manifest, and 100% detachment from everything material will be there. Okay. Hare Krishna. Any questions?
Thanks for the class, Maharaj. In the preface to the Nectar of Instruction, Srila Prabhupada mentions that a devotee has to rise to the mode of goodness before he can come to the stage of bhava and of so raganuga bhakti, then bhava bhakti. So, and also we find in the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's in the third canto, I think it is, there's a description of devotional service performed
in the
mode of ignorance,
yeah.
Performed in the mode of passion.
And they're all bad.
And the mode of goodness. And also in the 11th canto, I think, also there's a similar.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that bhakti is nirguna, but we find these references to bhakti being influenced, or even the bhakta having to come to the stage of goodness.
Yeah.
You know, as a Goswami, we control our senses, and so it seems that, and even at the stage of nishta, one has to be steady, and that's a characteristic of goodness.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, there seems to be a dilemma here.
Yeah.
Well, how do we resolve that?
Yeah.
Apparently,
the idea of tamogun bhakti, rajogun bhakti, and sattvagun bhakti is described by Kapila Dev there. And I think the commentary says that actually bhakti is not in the gunas at all. And if you look in the 11th canto there, Krishna describes to Uddhava things in the gunas. This is in tamogun, this is rajogun, this is sattvagun. And then in sattvagun he says, well, jnana is in sattvagun, or like that. And he says, bhakti is nirguna. Like that. So he makes all sorts of examples like this to show the difference of bhakti or places, and then he goes to the different places, and the temple of the Lord is nirguna, like this. So technically, yes, the bhakti is nirguna, and the same with the holy name. Holy name is Nama Chintamani Krishna, and it is Sudha, Purna Sudha, Vimukta. It is never contaminated at all. But they may appear to be contaminated because of our contamination. So when you say tamagun bhakti, it's not that the bhakti is actually contaminated, but the person's in tamagun and he's doing the bhakti, and therefore the full effect is not there. It becomes something a little different. The same with chanting the holy name. We chant in namabhas, it is not pure chanting. We chant sudanam, it's called pure chanting. But namabhas, the name is still there, but it's like the name or the sun covered by the clouds. Sun is still the sun and it still has the same power, but the clouds create a blockage so that the full effect of the sun is not there. So we say, you do our ananartas, we practice bhakti, and then we can say it's tamagun, rajagun, sattvagun, or whatever like that, or mixed bhakti, or pure bhakti, whatever, according to our consciousness or whatever. So the bhakti is pure, but our execution of it kind of changes the results that we get from it, and changes the influence of the bhakti. It may be less powerful, more powerful, etc. So by practicing these other types, we label them in order to distinguish pure bhakti by what result it gives. So pure bhakti will lead to prema. Mixed bhakti and all these other bhaktis do not lead to prema. They give other results. You do karma misra bhakti, you go this way. Jnana misra bhakti, you get some other result. You do tamagun bhakti, you get a completely different result. Rajagun bhakti, another result. Sattvagun bhakti, another result. Like that. So they're labeled like this as if the bhakti itself is contaminated, just to distinguish them, so that we see you get different results from these practices and not the ideal result. And the ideal result comes from the pure bhakti, which means our intentions at least are pure, even though we're not pure because we're still doing sadhana. Answer the question? Or now, as far as the sattva-gun, you have to be sattva-gun to practice bhakti. Of course, that's not really true, because we see in Bhagavatam the chandala or the sapacha, the dog-eater who chants the holy name of the ones Lord once, or remembers the lotus feet of the Lord once, then he's qualified to do a savana sacrifice. So he's beyond the brahmana instantaneously by chanting the name of the Lord, just by doing bhakti. So he was, by karma, he was tamagun, he was a sapacha, dog-eater. But then he chanted the holy name with faith, and suddenly he's better than the brahmana, so instantaneously he's beyond sattva-gun. So of course, through the bhakti process, we go through the gunas and beyond the gunas. But because we're doing sadhana, of course, we also are affected by the gunas still. And favorable sattva-gun is more favorable than the other gunas, obviously, because it's more peaceful. But if we come attached to that, then we're stuck again. That becomes an obstacle to bhakti. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hare Krishna. This story in the seventh canto of the Bhagavatam describes a sadhu who pretended to be like a python. We have other examples. Jetabharat, who at his birth was pretended like he was deaf, mute, blind, lame, like totally deficient in every way. And his parents were apparently very great devotees of the Lord. Why would he deceive them? Doesn't this show an element of dishonesty? Like putting on an act. It seemed like he did it very well. In the case of Jetabharat. And other examples.
Yeah.
Doesn't it show dishonesty? And doesn't it show a lack of saintliness?
Well, in the case of Jetabharat, I think the main purpose of all of this show of detachment was because he experienced as the deer. When he became a deer, he realized that he had made a big mistake in his previous life due to becoming attached to that baby deer, the fawn, and therefore he ended up as a deer. So he didn't want to repeat becoming attached to anything in the next lifetime. So therefore he disregarded his family and acted like he was dumb because he didn't want to take initiation, Brahminical initiation, and become like a Brahmana and learn all the rituals and do all that and become attached, because then you have to get married. Huh? You become a brahmachari, you learn the Vedas, then you get married and do all this, and then this is he wanted to reject that completely. So that's his higher purpose, we can say. Yes, probably you could say maybe it was cruel to his parents to do that, but he was more interested in getting to Krishna than anything else because his previous mistake, so therefore he acted like that.
This is Mahabhagavatas, they act like python. So somebody will act like python or practice to act like python to become Mahabhagavat. Because he is Mahabhagavat, so much in trance, he has no time to eat, cook, beg, and automatically he is becoming like a python. Because he is Mahabhagavat platform. He has no consciousness of asking, begging, eating, sitting there.
Yeah.
That happens. Or somebody practice to become Mahabhagavat. I have to become Mahabhagavat, so I act like a python.
Yeah. Well, if we practice like that, then this means that this becomes an anga of our bhakti practice to, you know, vairagya. So that's not good. It's said to contaminate your bhakti, and it may lead more into impersonal type of realization, dry up your heart, etc. So the devotees are not intentionally practicing that as such, or trying to attain that. What they're only trying to attain is pleasing and serving the Supreme Lord, and these are like byproducts of that. So they're not. That's not the goal of the devotee to do that. Of course, we see that some detachment is necessary, even as a qualification for bhakti. And in the practice of bhakti, we do have some detachment rules, like the four regulative principles we follow. To that extent, we practice our detachment. But more than that, to say that in order to advance, then I'll have to, you know, renounce eating or eat once every week or something, or like this, you know, that's not our sadhana. We have some minimum rules of detachment, but mainly the idea is to engage more and more in the practices of bhakti.
So that means during sadhana stage, knowingly, we are trying to practice some detachment, knowingly, to be detached. But at one point, we'll be so much conscious, Krishna conscious, that we don't recognize that detachment part. Automatically that happens.
Now, of course, there's exceptions also. The devotee generally is not a preacher. He's just absorbed in Krishna and not attached to his material body. Doesn't even know if his body exists half of the time. Doesn't care about eating or sleeping at all because he's like in a samadhi state with the Lord. But then we have exceptions also. Some devotees may act completely differently. So an example is given like Narada Muni. He's an uttama, but he's singing the glories of the Lord and preaching to people, going around, making distinctions between the devotee and the demon, making arrangements, etc. So sometimes the devotee may also act in that way. It's not that they all have to act like this, but this is a kind of general Uttamadhikari, but then we have the others who may act as great preachers as well.
Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada says very clearly that sometimes Krishna sends through the demons so that he could fight and exercise his body. And also, he says that to show the prowess to the living entities.
Yeah.
So, for example, Kamsa, he came and oppressed many devotees. So ultimately Krishna fought with him and then he killed him.
Mm-hmm.
So does Ravana. Do you think these kind of demons, they are prema bhaktas?
Uh-huh. Yeah. No, so the normal demons are demons. But the Lord himself doesn't hate them in any way. And he utilizes them for certain purposes in his pastimes. So as you said, through the pastime, the devotees get pleasure. For instance, when the demon is killed, like Sukadeva is reciting the story, and when Kamsa gets killed or Sishupala gets killed, then Sukadeva becomes joyful. So the devotees get pleasure. But the Lord himself is not hating anybody in any of these processes. Rather, he's benefiting them. So Sishupala gets liberation, or he goes to Vaikuntha, etc. So the Lord has many purposes to fulfill. One, of course, is the demons are actually bad people and harassing the devotees and persecuting the brahmanas and doing a dharma, etc. And they have to be eliminated. They're part of the demonic element of the world, and that has to be suppressed in order that dharma prospers. So the Lord comes to do that. But then simultaneously he's doing this, he's pleasing the devotees, he's exercising his own prowess, and getting pleasure from killing the demon, which is part of his rasa as well. So he accomplishes many things by one particular act.
Could you please give an example of a demon who is a prema bhakta?
What's his name? Yeah, Richard. That's a good example. So Richard Sura is a great example of that. Yeah? Now, as for the prema bhakta, even the real demons, the devotee will, prema bhakta will think of them as a prema bhakta, but actually they're not. But he'll impose that, just as he'll impose on the tree is serving the Lord with flowers and fruit, even if it's not actually conscious to that degree. So that's only the projection of the prema bhakta upon everything in the material world, not that they're actually all prema bhaktas.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we have to end here. It's 9:00. Hare Krishna.